Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
If you could have found a bigger book to hide behind, I'd like to know where it is. This book measures about 4.5 feet tall, and it's about maybe 7 feet wide. Dr. History, good morning.
Good morning, Zeb. And it's all I could do to carry this book
in
here.
You come in like the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
No, it's a great book. Anyway, we're going to continue with last week. I talked about the Snake River Plains.
Yeah.
And we didn't quite get through it. And I want to thank Ray Bagby.
Isn't he a nice guy?
Oh, super nice guy. Yeah. He's the guy that has built that exact replica of a stagecoach and a hearse. Super nice guy.
Absolutely.
Anyway, he called me and gave me some information about Fort Hall and Fort Boise. But I've got to say, Zeb, we were up to Island Park and West Yellowstone this last week, and I met some very nice people, a couple from North Carolina.
Really?
And I invited them to
Tar Heels.
Tune in to our show.
Yeah, North Carolina Tar Heels.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. Well, now, what about worldwide, nationwide, et cetera? Are you getting a lot of people to respond?
I get emails about every week from listeners all
around. So do I, but not many of which we can put on the air.
Well, mine are good, Zeb. So the Snake River Plain, you know, when you think about back in the 1800s, this was a barren, worthless-looking country, not much rain. I mean, the dust would fill your lungs and your eyes and your ears. But, you know, Eliza Spaulding and Narcissa Whitman, they were the first females to come across. And by wagon, they made it as far as Fort Boise. And that opened up the country for immigrants to start coming to the far west.
Now, what about those two women? I mean, did they travel with each other, or were
they
traveling
together
with their families, with their husbands and their families.
Right, they were together with their husbands, and that's what really opened up the immigration.
If you tip that book over, my computer and everything's going to go over on the floor.
I'm hanging on, Zeb. I'm hanging on. So anyway, you know, it was the travelers got out this direction. They could stop at Fort Hall and some of these places and trade 6 worn-out oxen for 4 healthy, good ones. Uh-huh. And at Fort Hall, they got a lot of good free advice. And that good advice invariably was to go to California instead of Oregon. And some 60 miles west of Fort Hall is where the trail forked, with the Oregon-bound trains continuing along the left bank of the Snake River, while wagons headed to California turned south and west up the wide, flat valley of the Raft River.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
About Fort Hall and other locations that supplied goods and services for the settlers.
Okay.
Where did they and how did they, on a regular basis, get all the food and the goods, the rifles, the bullets, etc.? Where did they get all this shipped in? It must have been a pretty good freight service someplace.
Yes, there were Teamsters that would
come up from Salt Lake or something?
Yeah. Even far back east, they would come from Independence and bring goods to the Teamsters with their sometimes 3 wagons pulled by 20 mules. And you think of those mostly going down the Santa Fe Trail down that direction, but there had to be freight wagons coming this direction.
Yeah.
To bring all the goods.
I often wonder, because the supply chain, you said, well, they could trade oxen and they could do this, that, and the other. They must have been some big, booming places.
Exactly. And Fort Hall was one of them. But, you know, I think I mentioned last week that there was a couple that were coming to the fork where they had to decide whether to go to Oregon or to California, and they couldn't decide. So just before the fork in the road, they turned the oxen loose and let the oxen choose which way they were going
to
go.
You know what Yogi Berra said when you come to a fork in the road?
Take the left.
No, he just said take it.
Oh, take it. Well, so the oxen went left and they went to California.
I see.
So anyway, you know, those that went that direction through the City of Rocks, it was pretty rough, too. They had to cross the Humboldt Desert, which was as bad or worse than the Snake River Plain, over the Sierras by way of Donner Pass. But the British, they kind of minimized the hazards of the California Trail, and they exaggerated those of the road to Oregon.
Hmm.
Now, being Americans, a goodly portion of the immigrants regarded the advice as a little bit suspicious simply because it came from a Britisher.
Mm-hmm.
Until the discovery of gold in California. Oregon's green, fertile, well-watered, thick timbered valleys held a lot more appeal than land owned by the Spanish-speaking foreigners in California. Furthermore, since the British were trying to persuade them not to go to Oregon, it must be a pretty good place to go. So most of those, the wagons, continued along the Snake River heading to Oregon.
That had to be kind of a sad occasion when you've traveled almost all across the continent with people, and all of a sudden you reach that literal fork in the road,
exactly,
and they go to California or Oregon, never to see each other again.
Exactly, yeah. But, you know, now that the beaver was done, many mountain men had become professional guides. The $4 a day they were paid, an ex-trapper for his services, was the finest insurance against trouble a wagon train could buy. And despite the fact that government-backed exploring parties under men like Captain John Fremont were being sent west to survey the country during the 1840s, the Snake River region had long been familiar terrain to white trappers. And, Zeb, we've talked before, they came clear down into this area trapping beaver,
yeah,
clear down here along the,
yeah,
Snake River. We think of them mostly like up in the Rockies, up towards Montana that way, but they did come down this direction.
Do we have any beaver left in this area at all?
We do. Yeah, I check out some of the golf courses.
Oh, okay.
You'll right. find that there's some trees that are being chopped down, so they're still around here, yeah. But when led by a veteran trapper, a wagon train seldom encountered serious difficulty. He knew every trail, stream, hollow, hill, and landmark, where the best grass grew, where water could be found, where there was wood for cooking fires, where the nuisances of mosquitoes and flies were gone, taken away by the cool evening breezes, where cushioning dust rather than the hoof destroying rocks made the going easier, where canyons and rivers could safely be crossed. All these facts were filed away in his mind in greater detail and with more accuracy than in volumes of official government reports made by Fremont and his survey crew. The trapper's very survival attested to the fact that they had graduated from, quote, the Rocky Mountain College with high honors. And though they may not be able to read or write, these guys had it in their head.
That was a question I had. Were any of these people like Kit Carson or any of them educated to the point where they kept diaries?
Okay, one of the best books I've read is called Journal of a Trapper by a guy named Osborne Russell. And he did write all of his experiences. And in fact, he's the one that came up with the term Rocky Mountain College. And so Osborne Russell was one of the guys that I have referred to quite a bit as far as one of the guys that knew the area and also wrote about it. So he has some, folks, if you want a good book, it's called Journal of a Trapper by Osborne Russell.
Hmm, I'll have to get that.
Yeah. But the most important service that the mountain man rendered the immigrants was his knowledge of Indian language, his true judgment of Indian nature, and the respect of his presence with the train. The Indians knew that if there was a trapper in the wagon train, that they kind of better watch their step. But they would still play some practical jokes. They would bully strangers that they thought they could get away with it. Since this was their homeland, the immigrants, they were a little nervous, ill at ease, and they'd suddenly see a horde of Indians on a rise, and they'd come galloping toward the wagons, yelling, and, you know, it would paralyze the women and children and send their husbands and
brothers. Yeah, but wasn't that taking a chance that they'd start a shooting?
Well, it sent the husbands and the brothers scrambling for their guns, but this was an old, what they call an old hat to the ex-trapper. He knew what they were doing. A show-off stunt aimed to draw attention and scare the greenhorns. Now, if they didn't pay him any attention, it was just harmless. It would end in good-natured laughter, handshaking, pipe smoking, but as you just mentioned, Zeb, let some feather-brained pilgrim grab his gun and start shooting.
Yeah.
Not a good thing.
No, I mean, that's kind of opening the door for chaos.
Yeah. So, you know, you had to... That's why a good trapper was such an asset to
so
a
he
wagon.
Could say, hey, don't worry about it. These are friendly Indians. They're just playing a joke on you. Meanwhile, he has 16 arrows sticking out of him.
Well, at that point, you'd probably say, well, maybe these aren't the friendlies.
Oops.
Sorry about that, folks. Now and again, some opinionated immigrants who, before leaving the East, they got a bunch of maps and they've got some pamphlets and they considered themselves experts on how to get to Oregon.
Oh, my.
Okay. And they persuaded their parties to dispense with hiring a guide. Such persons who disregarded this common sense rule, it often didn't go well. Donner Party.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah. And others, there's a small wagon train of about five that left Fort Hall. They were late in the season. And instead of following the Oregon Trail, they tried to take a cutoff north across where Shoshone and that direction.
Is that the Hudspeth?
Uh-huh. And they tried to go across there. Well, they got about halfway over. They got caught in a severe, severe snowstorm. There were three trappers, and they were headed up into the Bellevue-Haley catchment area to trap for the winter.
Yeah.
And over at Fort Hall, the captain told them, he says, watch out for this little wagon train. They might be in trouble. And sure enough, they got there, and these people were in trouble.
So they saved some of them.
Yes. What happened is... one of the trappers had an Indian wife, and he said, she can stay here with some of our horses. We'll make a camp. She'll be okay. And so they loaded up these wagons. And, well, the people in the wagon train, they thought, well, we'll just wait for the snow to go away, and then we'll keep going. Well, the snow was here for the winter.
Yeah.
They would have died. They would have starved to death and frozen. So these three trappers took them across the lava field, Zeb, back and forth wandering to try to find a way. And they made their way clear over to the Hagerman area, Hagerman Valley.
Oh, my.
Which, folks, I know you're not familiar with that, but that's an area where they grow peaches and pears and watermelon. It's down in the canyon, the Snake River Canyon.
Yeah.
It's always warmer down there.
By far.
And there is feed for the animals. So after a pretty extensive trip, they made it down there to the Hagerman Valley. They left the wagon train there where they were able to survive the winter and then continue on.
It amazes me how these settlers could be, and I don't mean this to be derogatory, but really that dumb
sometimes,
to do that.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
So normally 50 wagons comprised a strong enough train to pass through the Snake River country with no danger from the hostiles. But at times, smaller groups of only 10, 8, or 6 wagons attempted to make the journey. Normally, a train must reach Fort Hall, folks, that's in eastern Idaho, early in August if it was to complete its journey before the bad weather came, and its livestock should be in good condition before the desert crossing was attempted. But at times, poorly equipped, poorly organized, and poorly powered wagon trains came late to the eastern part of the basin, and against all advice, tried to make up for lost time by pushing these exhausted animals and people whose judgment by that time was seriously impaired by the hardship, and it was beyond their strength and endurance. They were worn out, Zed.
How many miles could they, on a good day, travel?
You're talking 15 to 25
maybe
miles.
That much, huh?
Yeah.
Depending on the terrain.
Right. If it was flat, they could probably do 25.
Really?
But if it was hilly and rough, you know, 15, maybe less sometimes. Now, at Three Island Crossing near present-day Glens Ferry, Idaho, the main branch of the Oregon Trail crossed the Snake. It angled northwest across flat, dry, sage-covered plains to the Boise River, then descended that stream to its mouth. Here, the Snake had to be crossed a second time. Now, along this trail, the mileage was shorter, the grass was better, the going was easier, and the danger from hostile Indians was less than that along the route which followed the left bank or the south of the Snake. But self-guided trains, after a study of the map, sometimes they decided that avoiding the risk of the two river crossings was worth a few extra miles, and they took the longer route, which was not good. And usually they wished they had not, because there was a term called dry trail, and that was absolutely true. Drifted dunes of sand, gorges, sheer steep gorges of incoming streams, unending miles of glass, sharp lava rock. It broke down the wheels, it wrecked the wagons, and just imagine what it did to the hooves of the oxen, turned them into bleeding stumps. There was little grass, less game, and the waters of the Snake were often inaccessible. And folks, remember, there was a steep canyon. You could see the river, but you couldn't get to it.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
I was reading a book about a year ago, and I cannot find the book. It's here in this office someplace, which is understandable. I can't find it. And they said something about some of the wagon trains, and you'd know about this, had what they call a forage wagon, where they would go out and cut the grasses from the meadows and everything and follow along and then feed it to the livestock at night. Is that true?
You know what? I have not heard that, but it makes sense.
Makes good sense,
yeah.
But I haven't been able to verify if that really happened.
Right, and I can't verify it either. But okay. It does make sense that would have happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, this when they went on the left side of the Snake River, it was much worse going for the immigrants. And worst of all, the Indians in this area were less friendly to the whites than the others on the other side of the river. And with the rugged, seldom traversed, trackless wilderness of the Owyhee Mountains near at hand, it was they could raid and kill and vanish into the wilderness, you know, without being caught. And during the first wave of immigration across the Snake River country, there were two pretty bad tragedies that wiped out wagon trains. One was on this area on the south side called Dry Trail, and the other on the Boise River to the north. Now, last week, we talked about...
You're going to tip everything over, you know that?
Well, I'm trying to get around this big book. So I want Ray Bagby told me about Fort Hall and Fort Boise.
Yeah.
So I want to share a little bit about those. Now, Fort Hall was a fort that was built in 1834 as a fur trading post by Nathaniel Wyeth. And it was located on the Snake River in southeastern Idaho. Now, Mr. Wyeth was an inventor and businessman from Boston, Massachusetts, who also founded a post at Fort William, which is actually in present-day Portland, Oregon.
Are there still remnants of the actual location up at Fort Hall?
No.
No?
Nope. But anyway, so Wyeth, he was unable to compete with the powerful British Hudson's Bay Company based at Fort Vancouver. So in 1837, Wyeth sold both posts to the British Hudson's Bay Company. Now, Fort Hall developed as an important station for immigrants through the 1850s on the Oregon Trail. It was located at the end of the common 500-mile stretch. You know, it took about 500 miles just to get to Fort Hall. Now you've got another 300 miles to get clear over to Fort Boise. Now, there was an estimated 270,000 immigrants that reached Fort Hall on their way west. The town of Fort Hall, Idaho, later developed 11 miles to the east, and Pocatello developed about 30 miles south on the Portneuf River. Now, in the 1860s, Fort Hall was the key post for the overland stage, mail, and freight lines. We talked about freight. To the towns and camps of the mining frontier in the Pacific Northwest. So that kind of answers our question, Zeb. There were freight wagons coming through. And in 1870, a new Fort Hall was constructed to carry out that function. And it was located about 25 miles to the northeast, and it protected stagecoach, mail, and travelers to the northwest.
Now, was the United States Army garrisoned there?
There were some there, yes. at different times. Now, Fort Hall is considered the most important trading post in the Snake River Valley. It was included within the Fort Hall Indian Reservation under the Treaty of 1867. And this answers your question, Zeb. No building remains at either of its sites.
But do they know the exact location?
You know, I believe there is actually a monument at either one or both of those sites.
That's a shame there's nothing left.
Right. And, you know, it is too bad. But
What was the ending date of Fort Hall? Do you know what?
Well, you know, basically it's still over there. It's a reservation,
but the actual building. Yeah.
I don't know when it finally just fell into disrepair and nothing left. So I don't know how many years it kind of was still in existence. Now, Ray Bagby told me about Fort Boise. I want to finish up with that. There is a Fort Boise, an old fort up at Boise, and it's near the Veterans Hospital. And he told me that inside the Veterans Hospital, if you'll go in there and walk down a hallway, there's a bunch of pictures of the old fort. And I feel guilty that I have never gone to the fort, or now I know I'm going to go into the Veterans Hospital and look at these pictures. So thanks, Ray, for letting me know about that. But Fort Boise is either of two different locations, both in southwestern Idaho. The first was a Hudson's Bay Company trading post near the Snake River on what is now the Oregon border. So quite a bit farther west and
over by Ontario.
Right, over close to the border.
Yeah.
So quite a ways farther than the actual town of Boise now. Now, after several rebuilds, the fort was ultimately abandoned in 1854. The second was established by the U.S. government in 1863 as a military post located 50 miles to the east up the Boise River, and it developed as Boise, the town we know of now, which obviously became the capital of Idaho.
Now, are there still remnants
yes.
of that?
Uh-huh.
There
yeah,
are.
Yeah, and that's the one I'm telling you I need to go visit. But the Overland Astor Expedition are believed to have been the first whites to explore the future site of the first Fort Boise while they were searching for a suitable location for a trading post. That was the one over by the Oregon border. And that was in 1811 when the Wilson Price Hunt Company came right through here. And they went through the Cauldron Lind.
Yeah, right over here.
Right over
a mile north of me.
Right, and that's where they lost some of their gear, and one of their men drowned going through that. Anyway, the Hudson's Bay Company operated Fort Boise until its abandonment from 1835 to 1844. The fort was headed by the French-Canadian François Payette. Have you heard of that name?
Well, evidently they must have named a town after him.
And a river.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. Well, here's what's interesting, Zeb. He staffed it with mostly Hawaiian employees.
Hawaiian.
And it soon became known for the hospitality and supplies provided to travelers and immigrants. Now, Zeb, where do you think we got the term Owyhee Desert, Owyhee area? Right there.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either. But, yeah, because of the Hawaiian employees.
Owyhee, Hawaii.
Yeah. And so southwestern Idaho, folks, is referred to as the Owyhee Desert.
I got to run.
One last thing. Well, no, that's it.
I do have to run out of time.
I know.
Unfortunate. I'd like to have more. Let's do it again next week.
Okay. I'll see what I can find.
Absolutely.
But that's the story.
I didn't know
River
that
Plain.
About the Hawaii and Owyhee.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, large area.
Okay. Well, there you go. Our trek across the Snake River Plain.